Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Tuesday Night Discussion Group. And for February 18th, 2014, we're glad to have some of our friends here, Tom and Mouse Mom and Bruce and Forrest, as usual. I think we got one more here listening. We just proud everybody's here. Hey, this is going to be a good discussion. We'll be discussing Steve Ozenich's book again, The Great Pain Deception. Faulty medical advice is making us worse. And we'll be discussing chapters 34 and 35. 34 is giving aid and comfort to the enemy. And 35 is repetition, repetition, repetition. And we know we got to do that in order to get better. And I want to say before we start, I do need to let everyone know that this is a peer support group. None of us are medical or mental health professionals. If you have a medical concern, you should see a properly licensed physician. And we always like to say to them as physician when it's for it. So with that being said, we're going to give the summary off to Bruce. Bruce MC. Thank you, Bruce.
Okay, thank you, Herbie. Well, the first chapter we're going to deal with is chapter 34, giving aid and comfort to the enemy, as Herbie just said. And Steve begins this chapter with the oft-quoted little aphorism from Walt Kelly's comic strip, Pogo, "I have seen the enemy, and they are us." And this might apply to all TMS healing in a general sense. And I think the key word in this chapter is accommodation. That is, not accommodating to your physical symptoms and thereby confirming instead of invalidating the structural diagnosis. Some of these physical accommodations that people make to TMS are bending more slowly, sitting or walking sideways, favoring one side over the other, walking robot-like in a protective fashion. I don't know if that's like dancing the robot. Steve says that instead, as Dr. Sarno says, you have to abandon all physical aids. You have to throw away the pillows and gadgets designed to make money from fear, finally leading to the abandonment of all physical treatment entirely. He gives the example of Kim Chester, cited by Linda Marsa in an article in a March 2004 issue of Health Magazine. To make a long story short, when Linda believed her physical therapies, physical therapists, and babied her back, the pain persisted. However, once she enrolled in a special back pain program at the New England Baptist Hospital Spine Center and did everything the PTs told her not to do, like running on a treadmill, riding on a stationary bike, and 3 months later, her pain disappeared. But Steve said that attacking the area where the pain is amounts to baby steps. You attack it with physical exercise, which may result in less fear of hurting yourself, which is, of course, good. And it may extend your range of motion, increase your flexibility, and also puts more blood into the area and will remove toxins that have built up because of the ischemia, the low oxygen in that region caused by TMS. But in the next chapter, he calls these baby steps. They're good in and of themselves, but they don't address the real problem, because in the next chapter, 35, Steve lays out the real cure to TMS. That's in chapter 35, repetition, 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 which involves knowledge therapy. The key word in chapter 35 is containment systems. And Steve gives you directions on how to escape from your own personal program containment system through repetitive knowledge therapy to convince the amygdala to let go of the fear causing you to hold on to your TMS symptoms. Steve says he focused on a few major things in each one of Dr. Sarno's first three books. These are the things that he repeated again and again to himself. From mind over back pain, he said the pain is due to mild oxygen deprivation. the tyranny of the should, of the moral imperative, putting a lot of pressure on yourself to be good, and also knowledge therapy, which we're discussing now. Another thing he repeated again and again to himself, some other things, come from healing back pain. One must confront TMS, fight it, or the symptoms will continue. You have to know that you cannot hurt yourself because there's no physical damage. The idea that a nerve is being pinched is a fantasy. Stop all therapy. And he talks about an emotional barometer, too. And he says you have to keep in mind the rage to soothe ratio outlined in the mind-body prescription. So those are the two chapters in a nutshell.
And, yeah, you just said a lot.
I know. I concentrated this because I didn't want to go into the mechanism of how the amygdala reinforces the fear in the limbic system and causes you to hold on, because it's that fight, flight, freeze mammalian trauma response that really activates this amygdala and makes it cling to that symptomology. There's large sections in there on that, and perhaps Forrest could elucidate this, the neurochemistry behind this.
Okay.
I will try to simplify it as much as I can.
Yeah, all right.
I like.
Is that what elucidate means?
Elucidate, bring light to it. Looks.
Okay.
There you go.
Forrest knew what it meant.
Books. Let there be light.
Okay, let there be light. Shed light on it, Forrest.
I'll do my best.
Okay, buddy.
I like to think of the brain as having two main parts. There's the older part of the brain, which is the more animal-like part of the brain. That could be called the limbic system, or the older brain. And then there's the newer brain, which could be called the neocortex. And the most important part of the newer part of the brain, the newest part of the newer part of the brain, is called the prefrontal cortex. Pre means in the front, frontal means in the front, cortex means the bark or the outer rind of the brain. So it's the surface of the brain at the very front, right behind your forehead. And that's where your facilities of logic are. When you read a book, that's the part of your brain which lights up as you think about the ideas, as you reflect on a TMS book and you think about how it applies to you.
Of course, ain't that what sets us apart from the animals, too?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely. We have a very, very highly developed prefrontal cortex.
This is like an evolutionary development, right?
It absolutely
from the caveman?
Is.
Yeah, okay.
Yes. So that's a lot of what makes us Homo sapiens, is that we have a brain that uses up a very substantial portion of our total energy is just fueling this brain. And it's the neocortex and that really sets us apart. And the frontal cortex that really, really sets us apart. So when you read a book, the frontal cortex understands the book pretty quickly. As soon as you're ready to accept the diagnosis on a superficial level, you read the book and you say, that makes sense. It means that you've accepted the diagnosis in the frontal cortex. The frontal cortex is now on your side. Unfortunately, the frontal cortex isn't where TMS healing happens. I mean, it's an important part of it, but if you're not healing quickly, that's where you need the repetition, which is the subject of this chapter. Chapter 35, the goal of the repetition is to have the prefrontal cortex repeat the TMS healing ideas so much that the older parts of the brain, such as the limbic system, finally get it. So it's kind of like the prefrontal cortex is talking to the limbic system and saying again and again, you are safe, you are okay. Your body is strong. You don't have to worry, until this primitive limbic system finally accepts it and says, okay, I am safe. And once it does accept it, then it can let go of that flight, fight, and freeze response that Bruce was talking about. In particular, one of the most studied parts of the limbic system is the amygdala, which are these little almond-shaped glands or neural clusters on each side of your brain. And they are key to anger, rage, and fear. And those are the parts that we need to cool down and relax. So when you can feel the blood pumping through your body and you get all jittery, that is, that's been triggered by your amygdala.
So I know. That's repetition. Excuse me. Steve says that the amygdala is responsible for emotional processing and the expression of emotions. And he says that each time we think of these body areas or systems being worn out or crumbling, the amygdala reacts in fear because of the stored emotional memories of fear already within it. So every time we, going back to chapter 34, would it be true that every time you're reinforcing the physical by trying to work on your back, you're also reinforcing the amygdala's fear of crumbling or those areas crumbling or being worn out? Is that reinforcing the fear, actually?
So the amygdala is responsible for very, very simple processing. It is the most heavily, it's the most heavily studied part of the emotional brain because the type of stuff that it does is very, very simple. If you want to study the amygdala, you can do that by putting a rat in a cage. This is kind of a sad story. You put a rat in a cage and then you ring a bell and then you electrify the cage, and then you do it again an hour later and again an hour later, and pretty soon, whenever the rat hears the bell, the rat is going to jump up. That's a form of classical conditioning. It's a very, very simple, direct form of learning, a very emotional sort of learning. From then on, if you were that rat, as soon as you hear a bell, you'll immediately be terrified. And so what you're describing with the reinforcement from chapter 34, that might involve other portions of the brain in addition to the amygdala, because what you're describing involves additional processing, and that may have more frontal cortex processing or more other association areas within the brain could be at play. Regarding this, I'll draw your attention to the quote. He quotes Sapolsky, who is the guy who wrote Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. I think he's from Stanford, really smart scientist. And he says, let's see. I don't know the exact quote. He sent an email to Dr. Sapolsky and he said, "Hey, here's my theory." And he says, "Well, it's as good as," Sapolsky replied and says, "That theory is as good as any others, but at this point we really can't know. I think it's important when you talk about the brain to recognize that there's an awful, awful lot that we don't know about the brain, and it is exceedingly complex."
Yes, Sapolsky said, "I think the scenario you outline regarding the prefrontal cortex's interactions with the amygdala and knowledge therapy healing is probably the best informed guess you could come up with. So we don't know precisely why knowledge therapy works. We only observe that it does."
Exactly. And
so it's like we're back with Freud then. It works because it works because we see it works. We observe it and we see it happening.
Indeed.
So it's like black box, white box theory again. We're positing a mechanism in there because of its outcome and our observations of those outcomes. And that's our best guess. And it's kind
yeah,
of
our
fuzzy logic, but it's...
Our best guess is the results that we see, right? The results.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Herbie, I got another thing I'm dying to say about the limbic system, but come back to me later on. It'd probably be good to let someone else talk a little bit.
Okay, Bruce, go ahead and finish.
Steve says that this is the way the prefrontal cortex works. So we import healing symbols and new mental imagery through the prefrontal cortex, which causes the conditioned and unconditioned responses in the physical body. What we imagine our bodies adapt to. When told our bodies are flawed through faulty medical advice, our mind bodies adapt to that image. And he uses this, Steve uses this example of India, of elephants that are trained in India and Thailand. Let's see, I put something down here about, they're tethered with a big chain and an iron pole. And once they've been conditioned to believe that they're constrained, then the mahout, as part of the training process, can replace the iron pole with a stick and the chain with a string. But the elephant still believes that he is constrained by the chain and the iron pole. So is that like what happens with TMS conditioning?
It would seem like it.
Yeah. It seems like, have you ever pressed your arm against a wall really hard with it down at your sides? Well, when you pull away from the wall, your arm will automatically rise up once the pressure is relieved, because your central nervous system still believes that you're pressing against the wall, even when the wall is no longer there. It's still firing off those messages. That's a form of conditioning too, isn't it? That's mind-body conditioning at its most primary. I just think some of the bits of knowledge that Steve says to repeat over and over again are interesting, because this constitutes knowledge therapy. This is the kind of information you're trying to get in to your limbic system to decondition or deprogram the fear response. You stop all therapy because you're really not hurt, because therapy sends a message to your brain that there's something wrong with you physically. You have to keep the idea in your mind that you can't hurt yourself. You can't succumb to the fantasy of a pinched nerve. You have to confront TMS as TMS, or the symptoms will continue. I was interested in this rage to soothe ratio. I think that operates quite a bit in this. If you have a soother, if you have a maternal figure, for example, who tells you it's all right, you're a good boy, and that soothing figure is removed from your environment, that can be the tipping point. Where
is that part of your experience? I think you've mentioned that specifically, right, Bruce?
Yeah, I think so. Well, I've been doing these program dreams all week.
And have you?
Yes, oh boy, have I. I had one last night that was just amazing. What I noticed was that after this dream, I had a vision when I woke up about the exact sequence that led to the onset of my TMS symptoms. Well, I'll explain the dream. What I do is, when I wake up at maybe 3 a.m. or 2 a.m, I will do a progressive relaxation breathing exercise and then do some deep breathing and then go back to sleep. Well, doing this procedure, I have had a sequence of dreams all week in Technicolor, but the last night was the whopper. I was at my late aunt's house with all of my relatives, who are all dead now. This was very Joycean. This was like James Joyce's novella, The Dead. I was entering the region of the dead. And they were all there, and I was going to a dinner with them, and I was going to drive them in a big white limousine that was like a hearse. It had that, was it a hearse or was it a limousine? And they all got into the car, and they all got into the car, and my aunt got in there with all of her dogs, but I wasn't afraid. I wasn't afraid of getting allergies from her dogs because they were dead. They could no longer touch me.
Did you know why he was in the dream?
There was that grandpa and my uncle and my aunt and my father and my mother all together, and they were not fighting. They no longer had a reason to fight because they were dead. And I was the chauffeur, and instead of having this white grip, death grip on the wheel, taking them to this dinner, I was instead calm. They were no longer in the conflicts that had existed when they were alive, and I was no longer conflicted. And I was going to this this fancy restaurant, and we were going to meet this girl there that I was going to introduce them all to. Well, we were getting into the parking lot, and I thought, oh no, we can't find a parking place. They're going to all start fighting. But no, there was an attendant who opened a gate on the side, and I pulled the big limo in. Well, I walked, and we all went into the restaurant and to the place where the dinner was, and I tripped. And I thought, oh no, I'm going to fall on my bad side. And I landed on the floor, and it was padded just like the climbing gym. Some element from the current time and space was imported into the dream. And we had dinner together there with this attendant who was like an angel, like some guy who's taking you from the land of the living to the land of the dead. And when I woke up, I realized the exact sequence that had transpired before I had my herniated, so-called herniated disc in 2001. I realized, one, my mother died. I was under stress. Two, I lost the contract. Three, I lost money on the market. These things were building. And also, the lawyer signed the paper giving me the estate. And at that point, that's when the pain started, when I was out running, trying to work off the stress. And it kept building and building through these things until that guy hit me up to try and get my money, try and give him 10%, try and shake me down. And then I went running one night, and I came back, and my tires had been, the guy obviously had come back and let the air out of my tires. And then a week later, I had my massive back attack. It was like bang, bang, bang. They were all building from that moment of my mother's death until I
kissed. And this came through your dream.
Yeah, through the dream gave me the clarity from processing all of this repressed emotional.
It brought it to consciousness.
Yeah, exactly. It was like, and. But anyway, it was interesting the way elements in your own personal life in the now get imported into the dream space, which is timeless.
Yeah.
But I could see how it is tension. All of those things built to a point where the tension was so great, I couldn't take it anymore. So I had to get sick. It was. But anyway, so much for these, for this dream therapy. I've been reading James Alexander's chapter on dreams at the same time too, and that gives you a lot of information in there about programmed dreams. And he is a popularizer, as Forrest says, but he does summarize and he puts it into a very succinct mode. So
absolutely. And he loves the research. It's
smart guy. So anyway, it does seem like, and well, the fear went away too in the dream because I jumped down into a lowered area in the dining hall that was like the gym and landed on my bum leg, but it didn't hurt, and I could dance around in the dream space. It took away the TMS. It was It came back when I woke up, but
that's so cool. Isn't there? I know you had done it through dreams and all. Isn't there a word for that? Is it epiphany? Epiphany? How do you say that word?
Epiphany.
Epiphany.
Yeah, that's why I was thinking James Joyce, because his novelistic technique is based on epiphanies, on moments of perception, uniting multiple layers of meaning. You know, the symbolic, the anagogic. He takes it from, what's his name? St. Thomas Aquinas and Aquinian theology, and adapts it to realistic fiction. Kind of a genius, that guy, Joyce.
Wow.
Anyway, so the way to undo this stuff is confronting it and fighting it and not being afraid of it. In that dream space, I was not afraid. Fear had gone away because my past had been absolved. My history had been, cleansed. Mm-hmm. And that's what you can do in one of those dreams. You can work with it.
Well, you know, after the show last week, I thought to myself, well, I remember how I have programmed a lot of my dreams. And mm-hmm. I would just lay down. The way I would do it, I think, is quite a bit different than the way you do it. But the way I would do it, like that, the night after the show last week, when we was talking about dreams and stuff, and I thought, well, I'm going to go in here and I'm going to tell myself, you know, what I need to know tonight. And when I done that and I laid there just like, and I remember how you mentioned that Steve had said that you can liken it onto a prayer. And when I laid there, I basically told myself what I wanted to know in my dream that I didn't know at the time. And when I went to sleep, I had a dream that revealed two things to me in the dream that I was conscious of, but at the same time, I wasn't conscious of how much that I was repressing these two things. So when I woke up, it had told me about two things that was basically a New Year's resolution that I had never got around to. And it was basically telling me these are the two things that's on your mind that you need to know now. And so it was basically like when I laid down, I just told myself in my mind, reveal to me what is it that's holding me back from being even a stronger version of me. Basically, that's the way I'd done it. And when I woke up, I had these two, revealings through this dream. And I remembered in the past, I could go to sleep and basically just about ask anything to be revealed to me before I went to sleep. And when I would, and I was using a style, what the Civil Method says and what Joseph Murphy says about when you lay down, just go ahead and tell the mind what you want to know. It's like asking a question, you know, and then it reveal this question to me is what you're saying. You're like, now reveal this to me in my dream. And that's happened to me probably seven or eight times as I remember. And every time I would tell my mind to reveal this question to me, it always did. And it did in a way that I knew I was conscious of it during my waking hours, but it was something that I was basically had repressed, something that was, you know, unconscious mm-hmm. to me at the same time. So it was neat stuff. It was really good stuff, and it's opened my eyes to even be healthier and to do a lot of things in my life to even be.
Steve says that this repetition of knowledge, a la Sarno, can lead to a means of escape from my personal containment system. But then these dream therapies can allow you to have instantaneous perceptions in the realm of the unconscious that would take a lot longer in your conscious work with repetition. You can have an instant jump, like you said, an epiphany. You can have
is Mouse Mom, you want to relate to this? I'm sure you are tennis. I'm sure you've had some dreams like that, to where when you woke up, you was like, "Uh huh." So it's revealed something to me. Have you had dreams like that?
No, I really haven't. I don't really remember too much of my dreams, so I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, it's really not a bad thing. Has it happened in your awake time? And then, you know, it's like all of a sudden stuff is going on, and all of a sudden you get this aha moment. Like, oh, that's what it is. Have you ever experienced anything like that yet?
Not yet. No, I wish I had, but not yet. No.
Okay.
Well, I've been self-consciously doing this for a week since we did chapter 32, and I read about Mackenzie's method, these power dreams. So I decided to do it every night.
Her method?
Well, you mean, well, it's not her. It's, let's see, Clancy Mackenzie. Well, the first four or five dreams were like latent content. Psychological content with a minimal of a narrative and plot. But this one last night, oh man, it means that if you just keep looking in there, finally it'll coalesce. Something on the outside that you're doing will give it a plot.
Yeah.
Give it a structure. The first time you might just get hints and you just get these symbolic resonances of meaning, but if you keep at it and keep
the repetition,
repetition again.
A lot of people, you know, Tennis Tom, Bruce, Forrest, Mousemole, all y'all know that when the new guys, you know, come on the site, we one of the first things they do is, you know, after a few weeks. One of the first things they start talking about is why ain't already better? And the main thing is
definitely
the repetition, you know, and staying with it. And basically, that's the information that I give. I go in and try to give some hope, but at the same time, you just got to keep doing the same thing over and over and over again.
Yeah, and that then, lady who asked in a string whether it was okay to work the SCP again. Because she was getting symptoms back, and I said, "Sure, very well." Do it again. What it takes, there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, that might be what it takes. It's just that, you know, just that kind of stubborn streak.
So yeah, do it again, do it until. And me, the way I am, I'm gonna do the SCP. I'm gonna do the Alan Gordon program. I'm going to study the book and after book after book after book until I get what I want. Because I know if I keep looking and I keep searching, the mind is going to find what you want. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't care what it is you're looking for. You keep looking and you will find it. And I mean, if it's a weenie dog that you can't find, it's a white breed. I don't know. You will find it. You know, I'm just kind of putting a little comedy there, but you will find anything you're looking for. For years, for like 13 years, I wanted to see a vision. I did. I wanted to see a literal vision. And I remember one night I went to lay down, and all of a sudden when I laid down, it just showed up. It just, out of the blue, it just showed up one day, this vision. And I was like, whoa, I'm having an encounter, you know? But when it was all said and done, it was a beautiful experience. I've wrote about it a few times, but wow. You know, I never thought in a million years I was going to ever experience. Basically, it was a picture while I was wide awake when I saw it, you know. But that showed me right there that there would never be a time that if I keep searching, keep looking, keep searching, I'll finally find what I want. And that's one thing that TMS knowledge reveals to you. Keep searching. Keep this repetition up. Keep looking, and you'll get what you want. You'll get it, you know. It might take some time, but you know. I like the way Steve puts it. The more effort we put in there and the more studies that we do, the longer it takes us, that's just going to solidify us to be even better and hold our healing more when we do get it.
I think Kenneth Tom has something to say.
Yeah,
I know. Flag here.
Yeah, I know. Tom, go ahead, buddy.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you make a good point. Y'all do. I think part of it is a watch. A kettle never boils kind of thing. You can try to get healed by TMS and try, but at a certain point I've remember seeing in books where you have to sleep on it and let it be absorbed. An interesting thing in the chapter there was that only 5% of our brain, that prefrontal cortex, is actually the conscious part. It's the portal to the 95% of the rest of the brain where the TMS is and needs to be changed. And I think Edna St. Vincent Millay's quote about Kitty, that the something about the mind perceives instantly what the heart takes forever, or whatever around the corner thing. I can never remember. I'm sure someone here knows
yes,
it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's the Sarno quote.
Yeah, that's Sarno's quote, isn't it? Right.
Yeah, yeah. So you have to have some faith in the, let's say, the system, that if like what Hervey said, just keep trying and trying, and eventually someday when you're not trying, it'll just happen. I practice my tennis quite a bit just for this I did, and I realize now that I practice, but then after I sleep on it or sometime in the future, that's when that practice will pay off someday, but I cannot consciously will it to happen immediately. If I keep practicing, eventually it'll just come once it gets absorbed into the, it'll become automatic when the autonomic nervous system, the involuntary nervous system accepts it. And that's the beauty. It just happens. It's there. It just, you know, it'll happen.
It sure sounds like enlightenment in Zen, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Like what? Like what?
Enlightenment in Zen. It sounds like Alan.
Zen.
Zen.
Yeah.
Zen Buddhism.
Yeah.
When you get it,
sure.
You get it.
Yeah,
that's like,
awesome.
That's like
excellent
when a,
point.
When
excellent
a,
point.
Thank you.
Like
thank
when
you,
a Buddhist
Tom.
Monk sits on a hard floor and meditates for day after day after day, and the master keeps coming in and says, "Have you got it?" And the guy gets more and more spiritually dry until he's completely worn out. And then one day, the master comes in and hits him with a stick. And that blow sets off the enlightenment process. He waits for that right moment when he just comes in and surprises him. And it's like he's put in the novice has put in so much work and suffered so much that finally that blow changes his mind so that he has that flash of insight.
Well, that's kind of what happened with Steve-O. He had his wife beat him with that baseball bat. That was it. That was when things started changing for him.
That's
he says, when I finally got it, the light bulb went on over my head and was so bright that my electric bill went up.
Well, and he does talk about it. Speaking of repetition, there is at the very end of the repetition chapter, there's a very interesting paragraph. So he talks about left brain versus right brain in visual spatial learners, VSLs. And he says, if you happen to be a VSL, and he's a VSL, once you have the overall concept of TMS, then repetition may no longer be necessary. It may be time to stand on Dr. Sarno's second pillar and act on the knowledge. Stop going over and over the same information, expecting different results. If your healing strategy isn't working, change the strategy to fit your nature. So I think that's just a core, it's so important, TMS healing principle, that we all need to be responsible for our own healing, and we all need to figure out how we learn, how these ideas get from our frontal cortex down into our deeper parts of our unconscious brain, and how we can fulfill that knowledge therapy.
So are you saying we should shift our strategies around? Like if knowledge therapy doesn't work, try EMDR. If EMDR doesn't work, try EFT, intuitive EFT.
He talks about, so I'm a pretty straight up Sarno person, and I think Steve is also. He says, you know, I think that knowledge therapy is always there in the background. It is the penicillin of the disorder. But he says that if once you have the overall concept, then it might be time to stand on Dr. Sarno's second pillar and act on that knowledge. And still the emphasis is on knowledge. But I think it means going out there and hitting golf balls or going out there and doing the things which soothe you and kind of re-immersing yourself in life. And that idea that I think we talked about a lot in here of just going out and doing the things you love, playing tennis.
Getting back in with life. Go ahead, Tom. Tell us a little bit about that.
If I, you know, some of the discussions that the team has helped, some of the big fights were over being, I've been accused of being a Sarno purist, you know, whatever. And it always pissed me off because, a fundamentalist, you know, it's like, and I'm thinking, Sarno says, hey, I don't know why it works. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the mechanism is. Early on he thought it was the oxygen deprivation, and Steve goes along with that too. But Sarno's point was, you shouldn't care. It doesn't matter. Just, you have to believe. You have to, and he says, go out and have a good life. Steve keeps emphasizing, the thing is, have a good life, forget about your pains, just do it. The Nike quote, just do it. And get distracted by things you enjoy doing and quit wallowing in the misery. So there is no fundamentalist, purist way. Everyone is different. Everyone has a different life. But the point is just get out there and enjoy your life because, you know, we're not on this earth that long. So the time you have, try to, you know, enjoy it.
Yeah, that gives me an idea of something I was studying the other day from a Hindu teacher. I don't study much in a Hindu, so I thought I'd read some on it. But anyway, the teacher is sitting there, and he's teaching his student, and the students all in the room know not to ask the teacher, the master, disciple, or whatever they call the Hindu guys. The students know not to ask anything about any proof when he's explaining all of these great higher truths to his students. The students know if they're going to ask anything, it's just to clarify a little more so they'll understand a little more about these higher truths, and they take them as truth without having to know any, you know, deep scientific knowledge about it. They just take it as this is true, and then they go with it, and they have a lot of success with their studies and stuff. We get a lot of success stories from a lot that they do. What do you call these guys? Do any one of y'all know their names? These Hindu teachers,
gurus, guru.
Is that it? The gurus, yeah. Well, you know, again, they just know, just like with Sarno. The thing is, we can tell you Sarno, you know, how he got what was an 88% cure rate, you know, but at the same time, Sarno really, he had to pick the people that he knew believed in TMS and was going to believe him, you know, and when he brought them in, if they're going to sit there and say, well, you know, I don't believe this, try to convince me. Well, Sarno knew that was, you know, impossible. These people's got to come in. They got to listen to what he says for the 2 or 3 hour, you know, like the video we had on TMS Wiki there for a while. Listen to that. Let it sink in your head. Keep letting it sink in your head over and over and over and over and over again. You know, and eventually you start understanding it. And then when you start understanding it, you start acting on it. And then when you start acting on it, you start getting results. And that's how it works. And the same thing with the gurus of the Hindu people. The students know that when these masters teach them, then they're going to sit there and they'll listen. And then they'll let it sink in. And then they go and apply it. And they often have a lot of good success from it.
I think it gets back to that key term in chapter 34, accommodation. Steve says, become relentless. Start walking straight, tall, and proud. Do not fear any range or type of movement.
I
you
like
don't
that.
Accommodate to it. You don't limp. You simply walk. You don't adopt a strange mannerism for shuffling along to get down into a chair. You just don't do it. He says, become relentless.
I've just gotten here going on 19, 20 months, getting back into weightlifting and all and doing all my exercises. I've just gotten to where when I go exercise, I'm not thinking about my body no more, you know? And it's probably been within the last 2 months because I'd always have in the back of my mind, you know, no matter how much knowledge I tended to know, I'd still have in the back of my mind, you know, it was almost like it was another mind there, you know, not my mind, but it was just there. And what it was the conditioned mind from since I was a kid to this Western civilization knowledge that, you know, if I turn this way or pick the weight up without bending my knees right, then I'm going to get hurt. But now, like today, I went out there and I did deadlifts and I was doing them, you know, with good form and all, but I wasn't even studying the body. I just enjoyed lifting the weights. And when I got done, I felt super to where and with the same weight 2 months ago, I was out of breath and I was, you know, barely making it back in the house. And the reason being is because I had my mind so much now. Not consciously, like I said, it was back there still being reconditioned, and it was like it was wearing me out to try to, you know, keep myself from getting hurt or something.
They call that covering.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah, like where you try and avoid using your left leg because your mind thinks it's hurt.
Yeah.
And you're covering. You hold it up, and you avoid stomping on it. You protect it, they call that, covering. And if you keep doing that all the time, you'll only reinforce that limitation. Whereas if you just walk tall and proud and jump and stretch and don't let your mind get in the way. I noticed that too, Herbie. My that second mind has been slipping away. Is becoming more and more distant. It's still kind of there hovering, but it's not like it was.
Exactly. Tom, you've had some experiences like that with different parts of your body?
I was trying to think of the term I was given. It becomes a conditioned thing. My issue is my right hip, and it's been conditioned to, like Bruce says, to cover or protect, you know, by tightening up. The pain is a message to stop using it, but in TMS it could be an incorrect message.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the term out, compensatory gait disorder. That's what I was told by physio once, that my condition was a compensatory gait disorder. That's similar to covering, and that's what I think that my TMS is. If it's TMS, hey, it could still be arthritis. I've had two TMS doctors tell me that what I had was arthritis and not TMS, and to get a hip replacement. So. that was a big that was two big nocebos for me. So
it's still a battle that's going on, and you're still, you know, going through there through the motions, and but in the back of your mind it's still there, what the TMS doctor said, right?
Yeah, and I've talked to Steve about it, and he said sometimes TMS doctors can be wrong.
That's right.
I also had Don Dubin, who I had some sessions with in LA, in conjunction with seeing a TMS doctor down there, and he said sometimes he doesn't always agree with his TMS doctors. you know.
That's right.
So Don Dubin disagreed too. So I'm kind of in this limbo, but I tell you the truth, I'm finding the journey to be interesting as to where's it headed? What's it gonna be? I mean, I could always take the easy way out and get a hip replacement. That's a no brainer. But in the meantime, there's some other less invasive type procedures I've thought about, and then also I balance it with TMS on a daily basis. So I'm just waiting to see how the story ends.
Yeah, you know, I've heard so many good stories that you've written, Tom, and you well, mainly answers that you would come in and give a lot of people that you help, and you know, how you get out there and how you go on and play your tennis games, and you know, and basically you're keeping your mind off from it. You wake up and you're hurting, and you go on and you play your tennis games anyway, and then when you're done, it's really not like it's worse. I mean, it didn't leave. The pain ain't left. But at the same time, you're still Tennis Tom. You're still getting up, going and doing what it is that you love to do. And that's one of the things that's always got me to, I mean, really respect you a lot, is that you don't just talk it, you walk it, you know? I mean, you do exactly what you're supposed to do. And man, I think we'll all take that off to you for that. Thank you.
Yeah. I just did a practice before here. I rushed to take a shower and get on board, and earlier in the day I ran in the pool for a half an hour. So, yeah, and it doesn't get any worse, you know. So, thank you very much.
Yeah, we'll see how it ends. And great advice, too. Yeah, I'm going to tell you the truth. I've heard and listened to a lot of what Steve's told you, and I think Steve's right. So anyway, we'll see, okay? When I say we'll see, I say that with full faith and hope that everything's strong. When I say faith and hope, that means 100% that you're going to be fine. Anyway.
Thank you. Well, one quick thing. I have gotten rid of a lot of TMS pains through TMS thinking, where I've seen other people with the same condition go running, get surgery, get invasive surgeries in their shoulders and their knees, all kinds of other places, where I've just kind of waited it out, given it time that it needed, and then the pain went away. So, I have used TMS for a lot of things, but mainly now TMS thinking to resolve emotional issues so they don't wind up becoming a physical issue.
I mean, you've had a lot of symptom imperatives, right? I mean, and plus you've been to basically every different kind of therapy out there. You know, that's one of the things that it got me interested in a lot of the things that you say. Was basically reading your biography or your story, you know, of your journey so far. And you went to basically every style there is out there to get better, you know, before even approaching the Sarno technique. And and you've had all those symptom imperatives, basically, or a lot of them, right?
A bunch of them, yeah. A to Z. I've done 100 rolfing sessions, a couple of 100 acupuncture sessions. So when sometimes I'll poo-poo acupuncture and other stuff, I've tried it. You know, it's relaxing. As Steve says, though, you know, spend your money on a massage, because at least you're going to get the most bang for your buck in soothe ratio out of getting a nice massage, a comforting, de-stressing massage.
Yeah, the rate soothe ratio. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
I like that. Wow. See, a lot of people out there, you know, you'll be like, well, you might have had pain, say, in the back or something, and then you start recovering, and you go through all these symptom imperatives, you beat every one of them, and you still got pain in the shoulder or something, you know? And a lot of people be like, well, you ain't beat it all yet. Heck, you've done beat 99 symptoms. You know what I mean? You're going on a good trail. You got a good number going to where, you know, like you said, let's just see how it turns out. I mean, look what all you've done beat, Tom.
Yeah, and I don't expect to be pain-free. I think that's the problem. People expect, well, you know, TMS doesn't work because you're not pain free. No, when you go to heaven, you're pain free, maybe. But you're going to have things. I get cramps. I just saw where Steve said cramps are TMS. I had a cramp in my hand, and when I said, well, you know, Steve says this is TMS, it went away in about a fraction of the time that it would normally take for that cramp to go away in my hand. I don't view it as, that's TMS thinking, and it helps to resolve it. Yeah.
That's awesome, Tom. How about you, Mouse Mom? Have you started dealing with some symptom imperatives that you could basically, you know, just think about it or focus on it or speak to it like Tom just did? And you know, it might be a twinge of pain pop up here or there, other than what you've you know, talked to us about before the show, and like a symptom imperative, pain in the hand or knee or whatever, and then all of a sudden you focus on it or think about it, and then it just goes away.
Not yet.
Okay.
My back, it's still just all in my back.
Okay.
I guess that's just my biggest struggle.
Okay, well, you know, you was told about the gallstones, right?
Right, right. Yep.
Okay, and we're going to know a lot more. We're going to hear a lot more better stories about you real soon, right?
Yep.
All right, I like that, Bruce. What about you with the symptom imperatives?
I noticed this afternoon when I was bouldering really hard, my wrist started to hurt.
There you
and
go.
I got some red marks where the tendons were on my left wrist. And left side, that's where I have all my pain in my left side. So that circulation, lack of circulation to extremities, has to be general on the left side. So that's why all of these other symptom imperatives manifest on the left. I had a rash on the left side of my head. It went away. Because I ignored it. I stopped obsessing about it. Then the rash disappeared. I kept thinking about disfigurement. I kept thinking about going to the dermatologist. Then I forgot about it for a while. And then, it's not there anymore. And then this afternoon, I started getting a red mark in my wrist. And that's obviously lack of circulation to the extremities on the left side. And it's showing up in the tendon. But that's part of a general condition. TMS is a general condition, and it can manifest in different areas according to its own inner logic that we can't quite decode, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I know when I had my massive back attack, I started getting, what do they call that? What's that? Where you get a carpal tunnel syndrome.
Oh, okay.
It moved in there. And I started getting it started puffing up in there. Then that went away. And then I got a rash in my back right at the same point where the pain was. Then that went away. And then sometimes it's in the knee when it isn't in the back. It's got its own internal logic. I don't know what moves it around exactly.
I didn't think for a million years that this might have been a symptom imperative, but again, going on 2 years working on everything and having imperatives left and right that I would do just like you was talking about and like Tom talked about, and I would look at them, focus on them, think about, you know, how it's not strokes or whatever, and it would just go away eventually. You know, don't fear it, don't focus on it, don't judge it or whatever. But one of the things I remember mentioning in my story is about how I had a hurt left toe, and it just kept pain in it for almost 20 years, but it went away, the pain didn't, and that was right off the bat. But there was something else I had on my right toe, on my right big toe, and I had an ingrown toe now ever since I was 15 years old. Well, you know, after showering about a week ago, I got out of the shower and I started, you know, drying up and everything. And I looked down at my right toe that had that ingrown toenail that I'd always had to cut out and, you know, keep fixed up and everything for a long time. And I looked down there and that ingrown toenail's healed. After 20-something years, you know, here's an ingrown toenail healed. And
happy birthday.
That's like Chris Reeve. That's like Chris Reeve. Like Superman.
They can be really painful. Herbie, was it a painful ingrown toenail?
Oh yeah, man. If I didn't keep the toenail, you know, cut right and everything, it would be very painful.
Wow, because I had a couple when I was a kid, and it was very painful and pussy and awful. So congratulations and hallelujah. I mean, I know what that was like. And if you got, how many years did you have it?
I had it since I was 15 years old. So, you know, I'm 29 now, Tom.
Jeez.
So it ain't been that long. 14 years.
praise the Lord. I mean, and I wonder, do you think that's a TMS imperative? Could it have been a TMS?
Until I started really understanding that it was connection, getting back connected with life and, you know, about the enemy was in me and all of that, until I really started understanding that and I started applying it to my life. And then here it is, you know, 20 months later, and I looked down about a week ago and I'm fixing to clip my toenails because I always have to clip the one in a certain way to keep from getting an infection in the toe. It was totally right, like it was when I was 15 before I ever heard it. And when I looked down there, I said, oh man, this is so cool. It finally healed, you know. But hey, you know, I attribute it to, you know, my lifestyle now and not repressing, you know, everything that comes along and putting those reminders.
Maybe your autoimmune system. Maybe it had something to do also with your autoimmune system and the white WBCs, white blood cells, somehow finally got in there and took over and healed that. That is the first time I've ever heard of an ingrown toenail as being a TMS symptom. And, you know, I believe if you had it that long and it went away, I'm thinking that maybe we should add ingrown toenails to the TMS symptoms that can be healed through the good doctor's work.
For real, I couldn't attribute it to anything else other than that, other than the Sarno knowledge and what, you know, we're being taught through Steve's books. And, you know, no way could I have ever thought of it any other way.
I'm with you. I believe it was that too. I'm not joking.
I had a lot of imperatives. That's awesome, Bruce. You want to hit on anything else?
Well, what I've noticed is that I have a habit of pulling my left foot up, and I wondered where I got that. That was when I broke my heel, and I had to go around for a long time in a cast, and I was afraid of putting weight on my left side. Now this was 1990. I didn't have anything after that, but there's something to memegrams, pain memories. I think that probably conditioned me to have TMS later, because my accident was so traumatic. I fractured my skull and broke my nose, and at that moment was when my parents told me to hit the road. Said, we don't need you anymore. Don't bother us. So abandonment and the memegrams, the pain memories, I think then when you confront traumas later on, it can reignite that. And that's why I get it on the left side, because it was my left side that was injured so horribly. And it took so long for the pain to go away. I think you remember those sort of things. I think it is like James Alexander when he was trapped in that car, injured. And then later on, he started having pain. I think there is some learning that occurs from traumatic accidents and the emotional context in which they occur. Very much like post-traumatic stress disorder. There's something to do. Well, long-term trauma, short-term trauma. You know, it can be just problems in childhood, too. But when you couple a traumatic event with problems in childhood, It's like incremental. So that it was like waiting there to flare up when I was under too much stress when my mom died. It was still embedded in my central nervous system, those pain habits. Even now when I'm under stress, I notice I'll bring my left foot up so as not to weight the left heel. That was learned at a very deep level. So that's just my two bits. I'm sure it can occur all kinds of ways getting this.
Bruce, how old were you when your parents told you to leave?
It's when I got injured and I had the broken heel and the fractured skull and the broken nose and big raccoon eyes, and I called them up for some kind of some soothing. And they said, "Oh yeah, your grandfather broke his heel too. Like, just get out of here, buddy. Grandpa lived with it. You could live with it too, sucker."
Oh, they didn't think it was a big deal. Oh, I got you.
No, I was like laying there with raccoon eyes, with a concussion, with a broken nose, and my skull's showing through my eyebrows, and my heel broken in 600 places. And they said, that's no problem for you, buddy.
How old were you?
40.
40, okay, wow. Maybe you should have Skyped them or something. They would have seen you.
They were finally pretty much rid of me then. Don't cost us a buck, sucker.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, but I can see how that got embedded. So later on, when subsequent traumas occurred, you can reignite those old memegrams, those old pain memories. Like if you felt abandoned when you were hurt in an accident, then when subsequent abandonment issues arise, bango, it can reignite that. Because it's always been in there. It's been, you've been programmed.
Well, actually, if I can jump in here,
sure.
This brings up a topic that both Herbie and I are interested in. You've been talking about James Alexander. We talked earlier about the amygdala and how a lot of our emotional memories are stored in the amygdala. If you put that rat in the cage and then you ring the bell and then shock it, it develops that shock its feet, then it develops that fear memory. And I think that's some of what you're talking about is, there are many different mechanisms in the brain for storing memories. And one of the most easily studied is the one that happens through the amygdala, this fear conditioning. And that's really what happens is if you have a traumatic experience early in your life, then that can get encoded in the amygdala. And then when something happens later on, which reminds you of that, then that makes that so much more powerful. Does that make sense how that's connecting?
Yeah, it's emotions and memory. There's a book by James Rappaport, who first was studying these things, entitled Emotions and Memory. And I see it's like an amplifier, right?
Yeah.
It's like on the same emotional valence, and then you start vibrating to it internally.
Exactly. It's like that two trauma idea that you bring up, that you brought up before of, and Clancy McKenzie, I think, talks about where you have one trauma early on, and then when you have another similar trauma later on, it's so much more powerful because you've been primed by the first trauma earlier in your life. Because you've got this emotional learning which is encoded in your amygdala that makes you so much more sensitive to it.
Vulnerable.
You're yeah. Vulnerable. Well, anyway, what I want to yes, exactly. What I wanted to say is that they used to think that those emotional learnings that were encoded in the amygdala were that you were stuck with them for life, that those unconscious emotional reactions that you have because of early childhood trauma or any other past trauma where you were stuck with them, they were locked. But Dr. Alexander has been talking a lot about something called memory reconsolidation recently, which says that, yeah, it's true that, once those emotional memories are consolidated, they're kind of locked, but you can actually unlock them by kind of re-stimulating the memory and then disconfirming it, which, I don't know, I just thought that was kind of interesting to be able to, I mean, I think that when people talk about emotional memory reconsolidation, they think, oh yeah, that just means anytime you're healing, that's memory reconsolidation. But it's actually about specific areas of the brain. It's the type of emotional memories that are stored in the amygdala, or similar areas at least, that where the memory reconsolidation research is relevant.
That's
Does that make any sense, Herbie? I know you care about that a lot. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That's what a lot of these power therapies do. That's sort of the territory they operate in, as well as these guided dreams, I would think, too. You can get back in there and do some work.
Exactly. And it's not going to make you forget what are called declarative memories. It's not going to make you forget the time when your father tried to choke you or whatever else. Rather, it's going to delete the emotional memory of that occurrence, so that next time when you smell someone who has the same cologne, it won't be quite as it won't screw you up quite as fast, because the memory that you the association that you have between that cologne and terror will have been weakened somewhat by the memory reconsolidation process.
Yeah, and a lot of times totally eliminated. You'll be able to smell the cologne or whatever, that, which is the trigger, obviously. But you won't even be thinking about dad no more when you smell it.
That's like with my relatives in the dream space. When they were in the car with me, they no longer had the same emotional charge for me
that they would have when
I was fully conscious. Because I would be expecting a big fight and would be ripped up. But instead I wasn't. Well, they were dead in the dream, and I was back there. It's like you can work in that timeless space in those programmed dreams where your current associations are not valid anymore. Interesting stuff.
Good stuff right there.
Yeah, I've just waited to go to sleep tonight.
Yeah. repetition, you know, and that was awesome the way Forrest talked about and explained the reconsolidation process and how we don't have to no more. We don't have to, you know, think we're stuck with this negative charge memory, because a lot of people they'll think of a memory that hurt them real bad in the past. And when they think of it, it immediately brings back all of the emotions that they went through at that time, and it brings a lot of stress with it and often pain. And now we got these new studies, these new understandings that you can get, you know, those fixed. You can get those traumas released, those fight, flight, freeze traumas that get stuck in our bodies. You can get them fixed now. With the power therapies. But I like the way you're talking about the dreams, Bruce. And when you was in the car, when you was driving and you didn't have that emotion, you know.
The emotion that I would have had if I was like 25 driving with all of these crazy people fighting.
Yeah.
But instead, it wasn't there for me.
It's like you're doing it through dream work, but you getting the reconsolidation through the dream work. And see, like I said, I never studied that much in dream work, but you're telling me the exact same things that I know.
I just stumbled on it this week. Yeah, this is kind of news to me about
what
you're
doing it in the dream world. That's awesome. Keep doing it and keep us updated. That's awesome.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that they won't all be as tremendously, you know, pregnant with
it's
me,
already,
as this one was. It took a whole week of doing it before something went bango.
But you're just getting started if you've been doing it for a week or two, right?
Yeah.
So you're going to go into some awesome realms out there. I'm going to do it too, and I'll be keeping y'all updated with mine too. So we'll see.
Excellent.
We'll see which one turns into Superman and can fly through the the buildings first.
Yeah, well.
I mean, I'm joking in a way, but in another way, you can myself, do what you want in your dream sometime.
I'll settle for a lot less.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna fly to the top of the pyramids, and I'm gonna find out the great secrets there in my dreams. And you can do the other things. What about you, Tom? What you gonna do?
Oh, wow. Let's see. I don't know. I watched Jimmy Fallon's first night on taking over the Jay Leno show, or was that last night? I want to see Lady Gaga. I think Lady Gaga will show me the light.
She was lit up last night. So guys, watch that.
or maybe Pink flying through the air. In Australia, but I don't know. I think we should mention Candace Pert, though. I think I just saw on someone mentioned on the site, thank you, whoever it was, that she passed away, I guess, fairly recently. I don't listen to the news. Yeah, and I go along with Bolt, so I no longer watch the news, so I don't know if I would have seen it on the news. But she's, I guess, someone who made some great scientific discoveries about the polyneuropeptides and their role in TMS, and I visualize the peptide chains.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so I think some mention for her, and hopefully she's up there, and we'll shower us with some insights and improve the scientific belief for those who need science for them to believe. TMS knowledge.
Yeah, that was Walt Glenview awesome. Who wrote that post.
Who was it?
Walt Glenview. That's Herbie's co-author.
Walt, yeah.
Herbie's writing the book with.
With Walt. Thank you, Walt.
If that's that's Candace Pert. I didn't know that. That. Oh man.
The book is Emotions and Memory. I think the emotions of memory.
Yeah.
Or
molecule of motion. Yeah.
Revolutionary book that Candace Pert wrote, letting us all know how when we do think, the things we do think does run through our bodies. It does make changes in our bodies, the chemistry and all. Revolutionary. I love her work. Guys, y'all been awesome. Forrest, do you want to add anything else? I think this has been a great show.
It has been a very good show, and thank you for wrapping it up. We need to do that, but it's been very interesting.
Great. Bruce, you want to add anything else?
Well, I could go on and on, but this sounds like a good point to cut it off.
Okay, Dennis Tom, you want to add anything?
No, thank you, Bruce, for your summaries, and everyone, I thank you, Forrest, because I learned how to do a meeting chat tonight, and that was pretty amusing. I've never tried that, and I've got renewed confidence that I can learn something new. I've never done that before. And awesome. Happy birthday, Herbie.
Oh, thank you, buddy. Yeah. Thank you, man. Mouse Mom?
Yes?
You got anything?
No, I just enjoy listening. Thank you.
Maybe after we turn the recording off, maybe if Mouse Mom, if you want any sort of feedback or anything like that, I'd love to hear your story and how you're doing.
Okay.
Good deal.
If you want to share, to you.
Okay.
But I've been thinking for a while it'd be good to do some like personal like feedback for stuff after we turn the recording off. But anyway, me just talking. I'm not gonna.
No, I can do that.
Yeah, we need a girl here.
Exactly.
Okay.
And we're really interested in how Mouse Mom's doing there, guys. This has been a great informational show tonight, educational and all. Really, appreciate everybody on here, your wisdom and how we can all bring it out. Bruce's dreams and Forrest's scientific proofs and Tennis Tom just coming out there every day and doing his games and the games that, hey, and all the knowledge, Tennis Tom. I appreciate every one of y'all for being able to keep on doing your repetition, 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 repetition. And that's what it takes. You got to keep doing it. And if we ain't the way we want to be this year, keep doing it and you will get there. Keep knocking and the door will be open. And I'm going to end it with that, guys. And next week it'll be chapters 36, 37. It's and we'll leave it there. Thank you, everybody.